Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
And the natural motions of our hand, which we are moving during the normal going forward, so this energy of the motion is transformed into the electrical energy.
Latvian engineers are working on a jacket that could power your mobile phone while you walk. Hello, and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Cyrus Farivar in Bonn, Germany, with what's new in the world of European science and technology news. Also coming up, you've heard of space tourism. So how about a hotel in space? Some Russian entrepreneurs think it's worth a shot.
It's not so much technical feasibility. All these things are absolutely technically feasible. It's whether or not you can get the investment to do it.
Plus, a controversial iPhone app in France gets pulled from the iTunes store. And an interview with a Swiss architect who has come up with a way to make inflatable steel. All that and more this week on Spectrum. Last week, Russian space officials set November 12th as the next launch date for their Soyuz space capsule. That comes after the failed launch of an unmanned cargo vessel bound for the International Space Station. The international space community, particularly NASA, is going to be relying more and more on Russia for ferrying astronauts and cargo up into space, given the recent end of the space shuttle program. But some Russian entrepreneurs are thinking even bigger. Several weeks ago, a Russian firm unveiled plans for an orbital hotel by 2016 and space tours to Mars by 2030. Jessica Gallagher reports from Moscow.
Orbital Technologies says it has plans to launch a comfortable space hotel for tourists by 2016. Company officials say the first module will measure about 20 cubic meters, about 706 cubic feet, have four cabins, and will be able to hold up to seven passengers. Orbital Technologies is a subsidiary of partly state-owned RKK Energia, which had helped send space tourists to the International Space Station until last year. Orbital Technologies Chief Operating Officer Sergei Kostenko says the new station will have many purposes.
The main purpose will be space tourism, to house people. It will be designed and built in such a way that it will provide the most comfortable conditions possible for the tourists' stay in space.
Kostenko says the hotel will be aimed at wealthy individuals and those working for private companies who want to do space research.
The initial cost of a trip to the hotel will be about $50 to $60 million, which is about the same cost as a flight to the International Space Station. After that, the cost should drop.
Kostenko says the price of a five-day stay at the orbital hotel for a space tourist will be about $1 million. Company officials say the proposed hotel will be more comfortable than the International Space Station, but it won't be luxurious. Visitors to the hotel will have to use vacuum toilets, take sponge baths, and eat space food. Despite the inconveniences, Anastasia, who didn't want to use her last name, is intrigued by the idea of trying out outer space.
I would like to take the flight, but only if it becomes more accessible in price. Then I'll definitely take it.
Russia is the only country ferrying astronauts to the space station since the U.S. Space Agency retired its shuttle fleet. NASA is working with several commercial companies to develop a new spacecraft for ISS flights. Many experts say it will be difficult for the Russian space company to reach its goals of having the orbital hotel open by 2016 due to a lack of funding. Even the head of Russia's Federal Space Agency, Anatoly Perminov, says the country faces obstacles when it comes to space tourism. Here he is addressing the issue on state-run television.
Of course, we would like to resume this program. Unfortunately, we are unable to do it now, and we won't be able to do it until even 2017.
British professor Alan Smith from the Mullard Space Science Laboratory says it's all about the money. He also addressed the investment issue on Russia's English language television station.
It's not so much technical feasibility. All these things are absolutely technically feasible. It's whether or not you can get the investment to do it. These days, we have to work together because it's just all too expensive to do it on your own. The scientists, of course, are irritated by this. But the politicians, if you like, have to bear that in mind. So the politics is there. It's economics more than politics.
Meanwhile, Russia has grounded its Soyuz rockets until November after an unmanned cargo vessel headed for the space station failed to reach orbit and crashed into Siberia. It was the 44th launch of a Progress supply ship in the space station and the first failure in the nearly 13-year life of the complex. While the International Space Station has more than enough supplies, the accident threatens to delay the launch of the next crew, just a month away. That's because the upper stage of the unmanned rocket that failed is similar to the ones used to launch astronauts to the station. Jessica Gallagher, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
dwworld.de, Deutsche Welle's internet website. We bring you news and views from a European perspective. You'll find information about current affairs, business and economics, culture and lifestyle. You can even learn German with our online German courses. And of course, we bring you the latest program details for DWTV and DW Radio. Deutsche Welle on the internet at dwworld.de.
You're listening to Spectrum on Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm Cyrus Farivar. Remember, if you can't get to a radio when Spectrum comes on in your area, don't worry. You can listen anytime at dw-world.de/spectrum via streaming audio or as a podcast. Both are really easy and completely free to access. You can also see what I'm reading and get a taste of what we're working on between shows on Twitter at dw_scitech. And now, it's time for our new weekly tech feature, Digital Europe.
Digital Europe, bringing the continent's tech scene to your ears.
Now, over on Russia's western border, scientists in Latvia have been working on a new way to use body movements to generate electricity to power small electronic gadgets. The idea is to harness energy released while you walk. This idea has been around for many years. Irish scientists, for example, have already designed a backpack which generates electricity using the body's own movements. But now, Latvian engineers have built a small electric generator which can be integrated into clothing, specifically into a windbreaker-type jacket. Gaidurts Gelzis reports from Riga.
The autumn is fast approaching in Latvia, and many city dwellers have already started to wear thick jackets. But pretty soon jackets might not just keep Latvians warm, but could also power various small gadgets like a health monitor. Jurijs Blums is a physicist at Riga Technical University. He's one of five Latvian scientists who created this prototype. The jacket uses electromagnetic induction. Normally, induction requires a big coil of wire, but reducing the size of the coil is the real innovation here.
What is very important, our system are flat. So it is not necessary to take a bag, or it's necessary to add this system to place it in a pocket, for example.
Blums puts on a normal-looking greenish man's jacket. The flat induction coils on each side are not noticeable at all. They are only 1.5 centimeters in diameter each. There's also a tiny standard microelectronic transformer, which is placed beside the coils. Its job is to turn the energy into electricity.
Coils are placed here in the side of the jacket, and at the end of the sleeve we have this magnet. So, and the natural motions of our hand, which we are moving during the normal going forward, so this energy of the motion is transformed into the electrical energy.
The average walking speed for people is around 5 kilometers per hour. That means that a pedestrian can generate 200 to 300 microwatts during an hour, so powering an iPhone would take several hours. This is enough to power wireless sensors for up to 6 hours. There are about 16 interconnected coils hidden in both sides of the jacket at the pocket area, and they would be sewn in layers with up to 4 coils at a time. And the more coils, the faster the jacket can produce electricity. But there are limitations, as too many coils will start to deform the cloth. That's why there's an alternative to attach the spirals to the surface of the clothing. Osma Williamson is a professor at the Textile Technology and Design Institute at the Riga Technical University. She's also involved in this project.
The coil can be turned into an element of decoration. It can be hidden in a crocheted apple or in a star made in different techniques of embroidery, for instance. In this case, the decorations depend on the design of clothing and whether they go together well.
Williamson adds that she and her colleagues are looking for ways how the power generator could be made airtight. That would make the technology water-resistant and washable too. The idea to harvest the body's energy to produce electricity has aroused interest in the National Armed Forces of Latvia. The military is keen to use such energy harvesters for the so-called Combat Individual Protection System. That includes all the standard gear, camouflage systems, helmets, sleeping bags, boots, night vision goggles and more. The technology would allow the soldiers to recharge the devices while they are in the field, and they wouldn't have to carry extra batteries with them. Igor Shitvienkins is researcher at the Defense Science Research Center at the Latvian Army. He says that technology like this would be useful in a special ventilation vest, which is now being tested by Latvian soldiers in Afghanistan.
There is two fans inside the vest, autonomically is powered by the rechargeable batteries. And you just put on the side, with the special inside the special pockets, and they start to blow. And you can prevent yourself from this overheating.
There's also a similar heating vest, which is studied along the ventilation vest. Only in this case, it would warm up the soldiers in winter conditions. Though both the vests are not yet available to the soldiers, they could one day be powered by the energy harvesters if the vests are approved by the Ministry of Defense. Still, the Latvian research team says they need about another year of testing before it will be released as a commercial product. The researchers say it shouldn't add very much to the retail price. Jadars Dielzis, Deutsche Welle Radio, Riga.
Now, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about botnets. We've discussed them before on the show. These, of course, are vast groups of ordinary personal computers that have been infected with malware, almost always unbeknownst to their users, which can then be controlled remotely to infect, attack, or steal information from other computers. It's often pretty hard to stop botnets. However, last week, an Iranian doctoral student from the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands presented new research with a paper entitled "The Role of Internet Service Providers, ISPs, in Botnet Mitigation." In other words, his research shows that ISPs themselves just might be able to stop botnets before they get out of hand. Hadi Ashkari spoke at the Internet Security Days conference, which was held last week in Brühl, just outside of Cologne. I started off by asking him to summarize his research.
The question that that the research team that I'm part of has been researching in the past two years is whether this could actually make a difference. So this sounds like a theoretically good idea. And we've been researching on whether ISPs actually are critical points here, whether they actually do have discretion. And what we did is we looked at 200 ISPs worldwide. These are all legitimate A-brand ISPs, and across 40 countries and across a five-year period. And we started to see how much different these ISPs are compared to each other in regards to the number of infected users in them. And we found that sometimes of ISPs of similar size, there is 100 times difference in the number of infected users. So you have like two ISPs, look, both 5 million subscribers, and one of them you have 10,000 infected subscribers, and the other half you have 1 million. I'm exaggerating the numbers here. You can look at the actual numbers. But I just want to say there is actually 100 times difference in our data. And we found out that 80% of bots are located in these 200 ISPs. So why is this important? Because they say in the Internet, there are tens of thousands of ISPs. It's lots of networks connected with each other. Some of these are, in countries you don't have access to. But we found out that only 200 key core A-brand economic players, they control 80% of this problem. And these are brands, if you divide it in each country, maybe there's 5-10 ISPs. These are brands you can ask them to sit on a table and negotiate with the government. So this was very interesting for the governments because it gave them some points of what they could do.
Now, because I think what you're saying is that, because normally we associate botnets with countries that maybe are a little bit more closed off, Russia, China, maybe Iran even, I don't know, where it's not in the Russian government's interest, for example, to go after these botnets. A lot of times they're doing organized crime or political things, and it's hard for the German government or the Dutch government or the American government or any other government to put pressure on them to do what they want to do.
Yes, exactly. So
You're saying that, in fact, these botnets are active not in those places.
Yes.
Or less, there's more active in the,
So I can say it like this. Maybe the malware is written in these countries. Maybe the command and control servers are in these countries. So in that sense, still, we cannot go after those guys. But the actual victims and the actual bots, they are located in Germany, for instance. They are located in the US, a large portion of them. And there are lots of things that can be done at this point.
Okay, so you've come up with this result that this botnet activity is very widespread across many brand A ISPs, as you put it, in 40 countries around the world. So what do we do about it?
Right. I think this is probably a country-by-country decision. In the countries that I've seen, for instance, in the Netherlands, it was very interesting. The party that, the governmental agency that contracted us for this research was the Ministry of Economic Affairs, not Internal Affairs, not the military, but the Economic Affairs, because they're the ones who cared most about not this damaging e-commerce, etc. And they have an incentive to do something. What they want to know, now that they know that the ISPs can do something, right now in many countries they're using a combination of techniques. One of them is threat of regulation. So they're telling the ISPs, you have to do something about it. We don't know what, you know, but you have to do something about this. Otherwise, we will act. And we will, maybe we won't act in a good way because this is a very complex technology. You understand it better than us. But you have like a 1 year period to do something about this. This has actually been effective. So it has, for instance, in the Netherlands, it has gotten the 14 Dutch ISPs to sign an agreement and start sharing data about this. It is also in the ISP's own interest to do something about this.
But doing something would mean what? If you see suspicious activity, so, shut down that connection?
Well, you can take different steps. You can inform the user by, for instance, email. There are limitations. How does the user know this is good email or not? In Japan, they actually send out postal mail to the user. And it's shown to be very effective because people take the postal mail very seriously. And in serious cases, yes, you can shut down the computer and tell the user that you have to go to this website, download these cleaner tools, run them, and your system is going to be better after that. These kind of nice initiatives can be combined. For instance, in South Korea, there is actually a phone number, if I'm not mistaken, it's 118, that you can call. And it's run by the government, and they will explain to you in detail.
It's like a government tech support.
Exactly. They will explain to you in detail how to clean up your system.
So what do you think of that? Like, I mean, is that kind of the gold standard? I mean, is that...
That's very tricky to tell, because I think as an academic person, I cannot judge on that. I can just say the cons and pros, and mm-hmm. I think it's up to policymakers to decide how they want to spend taxpayers' money, who should actually do something about this. And these are actually the places where there's lots of negotiations going on.
All right, well, Hadi, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Cyrus. My pleasure.
Hadi Ashkari is a doctoral student at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. Now, botnets normally run on ordinary desktop and laptop computers, but they're becoming a threat to mobile phones, too. Earlier this month, Damballa, a computer security firm, found that the threat posed by mobile phone botnets is rapidly on the rise. In the first half of 2011, the company found that a large network of compromised Android mobile phones topped out at 20,000 phones. That's huge. So watch out what you download on your smartphone. And speaking of smartphones, there's a new controversial iPhone app from France. The app lets users find out whether certain celebrities are Jewish or not. But after pressure from French advocacy groups and even the Socialist Party, Apple withdrew the app from the iTunes Store in France just last week. However, the app is still available outside of France. John Lawrenson reports from Paris.
Juif par Juif, it's called, Jewish not Jewish, and for the sum of 79 euro cents, you can download it from the Apple Store onto your iPhone. The application, whose logo is a white Star of David floating against a blue background surrounded by floating question marks, aims to help you find out who is and who is not a Jew. A telly presenter, for example, Jean-Pierre Foucault, is quite a famous one. Well, it turns out that he is Jewish. Users are then asked to say whether it came as a surprise to them that the person was Jewish or not. The application contains 3,500 personalities sorted by job category, cinema, politics, music, etc., and whether they're Jewish by their mother or just by their father or converted to the religion. When Apple first made Juif Pas Juif available on August the 9th this summer, nobody much noticed. Then people started to talk about it on Twitter, and now, suddenly, outrage. Richard Presquier is the president of the French Jewish representative organisation, the CRIF.
On a sa vie privée, on ne doit pas admettre que quelqu'un d'autre l'expose.
We have our private lives. People should respect that and shouldn't be allowed to expose that private life, he told Itélé Television, whether what they assert is true or not. What's more, the law forbids the compiling of this sort of list. Cataloguing people by racial or religious origin is quite contrary to the rules of French society, Presquier added. And France is a country where the government sees the keeping of any sort of records which sort people ethnically as contrary to the liberty, equality, fraternity principles of the French Republic. The youth wing of the Socialist Party said it was scandalised by the new application. The League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism compared it to the lists of Jews created by the collaborationist Vichy regime of wartime France. Some associations have asked Apple to withdraw the products, others have threatened legal action, all of which has taken by surprise, so he says, the creator of Juif Pas Juif, a 35-year-old called Johann Levy, who is himself Jewish.
La plupart des Juifs aiment bien savoir que telle ou telle personnalité ou personne qui a réussi dans le milieu du sport ou des affaires est de la même religion.
Most Jews want to know if such and such a person who succeeded in the world of sport, say, or the world of business, has the same religion as they do, Levy says. In England, when they carry out a census, they always ask about your religion. In Anglo-Saxon countries, it doesn't shock anyone. So I'm a bit surprised that in 2011 this has sparked such a debate. Levy says the uproar here is a Franco-French thing, and it is true that a similar application has existed for some time in the United States without causing any stir whatsoever. But Levy, who lives in Marseille, should know that the climate here is different when it comes to Jewish identity, because France, unlike many other countries, has in recent years had a problem with anti-Semitic violence emanating less from the extreme right than from this country's large Arab origin population. In a country where Stars of David are sometimes added to the foreheads of politicians on election posters, curiosity about who is and who isn't Jewish is not always healthy. Perhaps especially in the world of the internet. It's a curious fact, for example, that when using Google in French, when you key in the name of someone famous and the person in question happens to be Jewish, the first suggested research area Google gives you is so-and-so Juif. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, for example, is not Dominique Strauss-Kahn Parti Socialiste or Nefes Satou or IMF, but Dominique Strauss-Kahn Juif. Perhaps Johann Levy is right that people are going to want to use this application for good reasons, but that, you can't help thinking, is not the whole story. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
And finally today, let's switch gears once again over to material science. Specifically, I want to talk about steel. We all know it as a very sturdy but heavy metal alloy. For the past few years, a two-man team from Poland and Switzerland have come up with a new system of making steel cheaper and lighter, but no less sturdy, by filling it with air. Oskar Zita and Philip Dolman have pioneered what they're calling free inner pressure deformation, a new engineering technique that allows them to make furniture. Zita Process Design sells inflated steel furniture, including ladders, chairs, and stools, for around 200 to 300 euros. However, more recently, they have been expanding this technique that may eventually have an impact on everything from wind turbines to highway guardrails. To learn more, I spoke with Philip Dolman over Skype.
So you have two sheets of steel, and you're pumping air in between them.
Yes, they're cutted with a laser, which is a really precise way for production. It's something between 0.1 millimeter. So it's a really precise method for cutting a metal sheet. Then we do the same with a robot. We do the welding. And it's again a really precise method. And then instead of using a third method for with a machine to form, we just inflate the space in between, and we get quite precise elements with about a precision of plus minus 1 millimeter. The nice thing is that any element can look totally different. So okay. We have a unique forming method.
Is the idea then to make it possible for people to inflate their own furniture? I mean, just now, like now we go to IKEA and we have all these things that are kind of put in this flat pack. I mean, do you imagine that, you know, in some time people will be able to buy one of these stools or ladders or other pieces of furniture that you've designed and kind of pump them up like at home?
Well, this could be possible, of course. So in the moment now, Oscar Theater is producing one of the famous products, is the Plop, this small chair, a three-leg chair. And in the moment, he's producing them and blowing him up at the factory. But of course, when you think about transporting 100 blown-up stool elements through Europe, this will take all the truck. But if you just send them flat, then it's just one huge parcel which couldn't be easily sent abroad and then being blown up at that point, because all you need is just a little bit of air pressure. So yeah, there's a possibility that people might do that at home if they have if they have air pressure. Well, you could do it with a bicycle pressure,
a bicycle pump
instead. Yes,
a bicycle pump.
Oh yeah.
Do you have any kind of definitive projects or other designs coming up?
We are developing this a crash beam, something, you know, close to the streets, in order to prevent the cars from going off the highway.
Right.
These elements are done by now with 6 or 7 millimeters of steel, and of course they take the energy from the car which runs into it by deforming. We want these things to, but normally 99% of the time you don't need them. You just need them when you run into them. So we want to reduce the thickness of the materials and scale it down to 2.2 times 1 millimeter and make a Fido element, these blown-up elements out of them. The chess saves a lot of material, and each kilo of steel being produced means 1.5 kilo of CO2 being produced that will reduce this climate-effective gas. So we have a light element, which is stiff just because of its form. It can start deforming really easily because it's so thin. But to increase the capability to, when a bigger car runs into it, so we need some strength in there, we would like to do kind of an airbag inside. By putting air pressure, normally when our structures are finally in the final form, we release the pressure. But if you put pressure in there, which means about when you put 0.5 bars inside, which means that 5 tons per square meter press against it and try to make it stiff and try to prevent the collapse. Now, by putting something like an airbag, like a gas generator inside, which detects whenever something is moving and some car is going to run in, we can produce more pressure inside in order to make the thing stiff, like the airbag in the car, just on the other side. It's like a small explosion going off, so you can produce really high pressures with that. The nice thing about that, the car industry will probably love that. After doing so, you have to throw away all the car.
Right. Right. Wow. That's amazing. That's really amazing. Philip Dolman, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Philip Dolman is a material scientist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. Want to learn more about something you heard on the show? Feel free to send us a message on Twitter at @DW_SciTech. But for now, that's all from Spectrum until next week. In between episodes, you can always find daily news updates at dw-world.de/science. From Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn, Germany, I'm Cyrus Farivar, and thanks for listening.